offering, loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari from the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust. We are in the last discourse of the series that we are going through, which is the 1991 summer course series. It's been a beautiful journey, to say the least. The entire series is on the Upanishads. We've gone through many, many Upanishads so far. This is the 13th discourse in the series, the discourse that Swami delivered on the 2nd of June, 1991. Before we have a short summary of what Swami spoke in the clip which we played last week, and before we go to the clip that we have for this week, let's invite Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Prip.
I think predominantly what Swami spoke of last week was the concept of name and form, and how everything that we see in the world is defined by a name and form. I think that was essentially what Swami spoke about, right? Where Swami was eventually leading on to the point which Swami would often speak on the theme of Namasmarana, where Swami would say that the name always brings the form along, that it might be difficult to go after the form, but it's easier to call out to the name. And Swami gave that beautiful example of, in a crowd, if you were to give the description of the form to a person, it's far more difficult to find and identify the person than if you have a name, and if you call out, the person whose name it is comes forward. That is what Swami was saying last week.
In fact, he was distinguishing between this form. No, it applies to something that we can feel or see, but also something that we cannot.
Right.
Like, so when we say anger or worry, like we need not describe what it means. Like, everybody instantly relates to what it means. When I say somebody is angry, they can relate to that immediately. So there's no form to it.
Right.
Right. Even if you can't see it happen in front of your eyes. Right. So. And so Swami makes that one interesting aside. He says that people should understand or investigate why the word God exists in the dictionary if people did not have the experience of divinity somewhere. It's because they had that this concept is existent.
Mm.
And the Upanishads, of course, have always been saying that this divinity is not something that you can perceive directly. Like, it's not something that the senses can perceive. So there's something beyond that, and we get that occasional glimpse.
Mm.
And that's why the word God exists. Mm. So Swami is reminding of that.
There's one of the theories which suggests how the human race developed and literally left behind the other species. And, you know, because one of the things they say is, if you look at the previous mammals, the chimpanzees or, you know, such species, an ideal group was something like 150 or 100, you know, individuals of that species. And the very idea that the human race has progressed is because that we have managed to form larger groups. And one of the reasons why that was possible was, very interestingly, they said the ability to gossip.
Language.
ability to... Yeah, more than language, it seems all animals communicate, but the ability to communicate more and to describe more events than the other animals could do.
Right.
So, literally, this ability to describe a scene and to recreate the scene in the mind of the person who is listening. And that is what has been instrumental in the progress of language. And with the progress of language, you have the creation of legends.
Yes.
And when the legends are created, you have a group which is larger than 150 or, you know, sometimes going up to few hundreds of thousands, which can be held together by common legends. Like, they would see that's what happens in civilizations, the Greek civilization, the Indian civilization, where you have legends or mythology. After a certain point of time, it doesn't matter whether it is true or it is a concocted imagination. But it holds the group together, and it serves that purpose.
Correct.
So this ability to, as you were saying, that you might... One thing is objects which cannot be seen, which do not have a form. And the other thing is to recreate the image of a form which you probably are not seeing right now, but somebody can communicate it to you. Somebody can describe a scene so vividly, and you can relate to that scene.
And that actually, one of the functions of gossip, right, is the reason like why we love gossip, or is because actually it is a natural function of the brain. because it is looking for how to survive in that situation.
Right.
Right. So what? There's always a what if I go through that.
Right.
So
right.
The brain.
Yeah. Though we are calling it gossip.
Yeah.
That is what it is.
Yeah.
The ability to better find food and better protect the race.
Exactly.
From, and that's how it starts. Really.
Yeah. So that strangely enough, like though we may we call gossip as something that is negative, etc. But that's how it's one of the reasons why the brain cottons onto that, or why we always say this. No, so why do the newspapers publish, or the media publishes so much bad news or mm-hmm. Horrifying news? But we do not realize that it is we the readers who ask for it, and that's why we are getting it. And why do we ask for it? Because naturally our eyes move to that. That's why good stories are very rare, they don't go viral as much as as bad news does. It travels pretty quickly. And the other side is like what you were mentioning, the stories, right? So it's important not just for mankind, but also management thought also recognizes the importance of shared stories.
Okay.
The reason they do that is because, say, a company like Southwest Airlines is a very good example.
Mm-hmm.
So, which stands for being friendly to its passengers while being low cost, and it stands for a lot of good values, right? And to speak about other institutions which, are written about in management literature. So the Mayo Clinic, right, which is an iconic hospital in the United States. The values, right, with which these institutions, they start, and the values with which they flourish, these are the core values. And these are transmitted through means of such anecdotes, stories of like how an air hostess went out of her way to, help a particular passenger and so on. Right. So these kind of stories, that is what gets transmitted down and down and down the generations of people who are working, of employees over there. And that holds the values together.
Right.
And that is why, the Indian body of literature that we have in the form of Upanishadic stories or Hitopadesh stories, mythologies, right? All of them exist because they transmit some very important values that the Sanatana Dharma stands for.
Right.
Likewise, we in our, the community of Sai devotees, we relate the experiences of Bhagwan among each other, like whenever we meet, right? And that binds us together. See, it kind of transmits that idea of like who Bhagwan is. So many of us may not have been that fortunate to have been so close to Swami, but generations down, right? These stories will carry down and bring that message of what Swami stood for. What did Swami love in a person? What did he want to see in a person?
Right.
What kind of values did he cherish? So those will get transmitted through these stories, experiences that we relate.
Right.
Yeah. So primarily that we should, understand the importance of like why Bhagwan keeps telling us so many chinna kathas. So, and therefore it is necessary first for us to keep talking about it, even if it is over and over again.
Right. Of course, in this context, Swami is talking about name and form, you could say in a positive light, but oftentimes when you go into Vedanta, name and form is always spoken of as something which is illusory, something which is changing, because of which you cannot speak of an object which has a relationship with name and form as being the truth. They always speak of that as being, mithya instead of satya, which is actually the truth. They say it's mithya because for a moment it appears like it is true, but it is actually not true because even as you're seeing it, its form is changing. You know, what you refer to as aging, or what you refer to as a normal process of degradation which you see. Probably we don't realize it, but it does happen. Right in front of our eyes it is happening. And, and that's what they say when you look at the stars, when you gaze at the stars, something like the sun, they would say if the sun decides to stop shining, you would not know for 8 minutes because that's how long it takes. So literally they say that when you look at every object around you, you're looking at the history of that object. Because, it might be a few milliseconds or even, not even milliseconds, it'd be 10 to the power of minus so many seconds. But still you're looking at an object when it was some time ago. You don't see it how it is right now. And that's how they speak of, how name and form is so ephemeral. But I think the point which is being driven is, it has a place and reason why it is there. As we were saying, even the stories that we transmit and share helps us grow together, but the problem is giving it too much importance and getting stuck to that name and form is what is detrimental.
Yes. Even then, you know, there's a way that Indian thinking, right, the Sanatana Dharma thinking, it still explains the importance of Namasmarana. There is definitely a paradox that you pointed out, that the devotion or the attachment to that name and form, but it is, as in scriptures, that is held as one of the highest attachments you can have.
Right.
Just as the desire for enlightenment. Right. So enlightenment is like is a state where you do not have desires, right? And you still have something called a desire for enlightenment, even if you have cut off everything else theoretically, right? So you have something called desire for enlightenment, and yet it is, as the scriptures would say, you should not have desires, right? So, but the Sanatana Dharma explains it this way. They said like, even for you to, it's like a thorn, right? Which so Swami would say, you need a thorn. To remove a thorn from your foot.
Right.
So if Maya, the thorn of Maya is stuck into your foot and you're feeling the pain of it, you need another thorn or another sharp pointed object in order to remove that thorn. So therefore it has a very important place, right? Even, so it's a paradox. Definitely in spirituality there are so many such paradoxes, and this is one among them where you hold on to something like that, which is illusory, but it has the effect of taking you beyond that illusion.
And I think whenever Swami speaks about Namasmarana, he goes back to this point of, you know, the name pulling a form, not necessarily form in the sense of a physical appearance, but form even in the sense of emotions attached to that name.
Correct.
That's why Swami would say that when you call to a name of God, you have this idea that God is all compassionate.
Yes.
God is, omnipresent and he's ready to come to your rescue. And when you are constantly repeating that name, it is that quality that you are actually meditating upon, though you are calling on a name. And Swami would say that's why when you can get concentration by probably chanting any name or any sound. You can take any, I mean, you can just start saying, tumbler, tumbler, tumbler. I mean, you can get to the level of concentration, but to go beyond to the levels of contemplation and meditation, which also includes this purification of our, antakarna, Swami would say, happens when you take a name of God and you have a certain qualities associated with that name and you meditate upon that.
Yeah, that name evokes the certain feelings, emotions, which are, which is something that we want to foster.
Right. I think that was where we had stopped, where Swami was talking about this name and form. And in fact, more than that, the whole discussion which Swami went into was to talk about this idea of God. And Swami was saying that you cannot deny the existence of God, and if that is not so, how come this word called God has come down and it has been passed on for so many generations?
Correct.
I mean, we've spoken about this so many times, but every time it occurs to you, the arguments of atheism actually are very, very strong. You know, it can literally take your mind by storm if you go into that.
Correct.
Because when you look at it, it is so convincing. But at least for all of us, I think many times I've seen myself doing this. When you're reading something like that or listening to some talk like that, you suddenly have to stop yourself and say, but we have seen God. You know, we have lived with God.
True.
And the experience which we have had can never be negated. It can never be taken away. And that is what Swami is referring to, not necessarily in relation to Swami's avatar, but the very fact that this has been consistent over so many generations and so many centuries, that there have been men and women, individuals who have had this association with this entity called God. They've had these experiences. They've had, it finally comes down to what Swami says. It comes down to your bias. You want to accept it, you don't want to accept it. It's not it is not universal, but it becomes an individual bias.
Yeah, Swami is to give a very simple antidote. He would say, maybe God doesn't exist for you, but for me he does.
Right.
So we are not trying to proselytize anybody, you know, to our way of thinking. We can definitely offer, okay, like this is the experience that I have had.
Right.
And the salutary experience, you know, that it has on you, the beneficial effect that it has on you. So that should speak for itself, right? Not the that's what Swami says. No, it should finally show up in your action. And there is a Hindi couplet that says, no, that even God should ask, like, you know, what is the source of your ecstasy? What is the source of your good values?
Okay. Right. So I think, shall we go to the next clip?
Yeah.
We'll listen to Swami's next part of that discourse, and then we'll discuss. For those of you who are joining us now, well, this discourse has been retranslated, and the voice of the translator that you'll be hearing is our brother from Radio Sai, Brother Sunil. And this is the seventh clip in that discourse that we're going to listen to.
Vidyarthulara.
Students.
Bharatiya Vijnanam anetuvantidi samasta shaktulonu kudinchi pettinatuvantidi.
This system of Indian knowledge is pregnant with all potencies.
Ee Bharatiya Vijnanamlo lenatuvanti yokka vishayamlo mari ee Vijnanamunandu kodunu kaanaravu.
What is not to be found in this Bharatiya system of knowledge cannot be found in any other system of knowledge.
కానీ ఆ విజ్ఞాన స్వరూపాన్ని మీరు దర్శించలేదు.
బట్ యు హావ్ నాట్ కాగ్నైజ్డ్ దిస్ వెరీ ఫార్మ్ ఆఫ్ నాలెడ్జ్.
దాన్ని మీరు ఆచరణలో ఉంచడానికి ప్రయత్నించలేదు.
యు హావ్ నాట్ ట్రైడ్ టు పుట్ దాట్ ఇన్ టు ప్రాక్టీస్.
కనుకనే దాని మహత్తరమైనటువంటి శక్తి మీకు అర్థం కాకుండా పోతుండాలి.
దేర్ఫోర్ ఇట్స్ ఇమెన్స్ పొటెన్సీ రిమైన్స్ బియాండ్ యువర్ అండర్స్టాండింగ్.
అందులో ప్రవేశించండి.
ఎంబార్క్ ఇన్ టు ఇట్.
దాని సరైనటువంటి ఆచరణలో పెట్టండి.
పుట్ ఇట్ ఇన్ టు రైట్ ప్రాక్టీస్.
తద్వారా మీకు ఆనందం ప్రాప్తిస్తుంది.
Through that you will attain bliss.
కనుక భారతీయ విజ్ఞానం అనేటువంటిది ధర్మమయమైనటువంటిది.
So Bharatiya knowledge is suffused with dharma or righteousness.
ధర్మమే జీవితం యొక్క ప్రధానమైనటువంటి యొక్క సూత్రము.
Dharma is the most important essential aspect of life.
అదే ప్రాణము.
It is verily the life principle.
ధర్మం అనగా ఏమిటి?
What do you mean by dharma?
అనగా ధారయతీతి ధర్మ అన్నారు. ధరించినటువంటిదే ధర్మము అన్నారు.
దాట్ విచ్ సస్టెయిన్స్ ఇస్ ధర్మ.
కానీ దీనికి సరైనటువంటి యొక్క తృప్తి మనకు కలగదు.
బట్ వీ కెనాట్ గెట్ కంప్లీట్ సాటిస్ఫాక్షన్ ఫ్రమ్ దిస్.
ఒక్కొక్క దారి ఎందుకు ఒక్కొక్క విధమైనటువంటి ప్రాణ సమానమైనటువంటి యొక్క సూత్రం ఉంటుండాలి.
ఇన్ ఈచ్ అండ్ ఎవ్రీ ఎలిమెంట్ దేర్ ఎగ్జిస్ట్ అన్ ఎసెన్షియల్ నేచర్ విచ్ ఇస్ లైక్ ఇట్స్ లైఫ్ ఇట్ సెల్ఫ్.
ఇది అగ్ని.
దిస్ ఇస్ ఫైర్.
ఇది అగ్ని అంటే అగ్ని దేనిని ధరించింది? వేడిని ధరించింది.
ఇఫ్ దిస్ ఇస్ ఫైర్ దెన్ వాట్ డస్ ఇట్ బేర్? ఇట్ బేర్స్ హీట్.
వెల్తురు ధరించింది.
ఇట్ బేర్స్ లైట్.
ఈ వేడి వెల్తురు రెండు ఉండినప్పుడే అది అగ్ని అనేటువంటి సత్యాన్ని మనం నిరూపించవచ్చు.
ఓన్లీ వెన్ బోత్ హీట్ అండ్ లైట్ ఆర్ ప్రెసెంట్ వీ కెన్ ప్రూవ్ ద ఫ్యాక్ట్ దాట్ ఇట్ ఇస్ ఫైర్.
ఈ వేడి వెల్తురు లేకపోతే అది బొగ్గు అవుతుంది కానీ అగ్ని కాదు.
వెన్ దేర్ ఇస్ నో హీట్ అండ్ లైట్ ఇట్ ఇస్ చార్కోల్ అండ్ నాట్ ఫైర్.
కనుక అగ్ని ధరించినటువంటిది వేడి వెలుతురు.
సో దాట్ విచ్ ఫైర్ బేర్స్ ఇస్ హీట్ అండ్ లైట్.
కనుకనే దానికి అగ్ని అనేటువంటి పేరు సార్థకమైంది.
దాట్ ఇస్ వై ఇట్ ఇస్ మీనింగ్ ఫుల్ టు కాల్ ఇట్ ఫైర్.
కనుక అగ్నికి ధర్మం ఏమిటి?
హెన్స్ వాట్ ఇస్ ద ధర్మ ఆఫ్ ఫైర్?
అనగా వేడి వెలుతురును అందించడమే దాని యొక్క ధర్మము.
టు ప్రొవైడ్ హీట్ అండ్ లైట్ ఇస్ ఇట్స్ ధర్మ.
ఇది ఐస్.
దిస్ ఇస్ ఐస్.
ఈ ఐస్ అంటే దీని యొక్క స్వరూపం ఏమిటి?
వెన్ వీ సే దిస్ ఇస్ ఐస్ వాట్ ఇస్ ఇట్స్ ఫార్మ్?
ఇది తెల్లగా ఉంటుండాలి.
ఇట్ లుక్స్ వైట్.
కాదు కాదు, ఇది చల్లగా ఉంటుండాలి.
నో నో, ఇట్ ఇస్ కోల్డ్.
ఇది చల్లగానే లేకుండా వేడిగా ఉంటే ఇది ఐస్ కాదు, నిప్ అవుతుంది.
ఇన్స్టెడ్ ఆఫ్ బీయింగ్ కోల్డ్ ఇఫ్ ఇట్స్ హాట్ దెన్ ఇట్ వుడ్ నాట్ బి కాల్డ్ ఐస్ బట్ ఫైర్.
ఇది చక్కెర అంటున్నాము.
వీ సే దిస్ ఇస్ షుగర్.
చక్కెరకు ఒక ధర్మం ఏమిటి?
What is the dharma of sugar?
Tea chakkari yokka dharmamu.
Sweetness is the dharma of sugar.
Tea lekunda gine pothe adi uppu ga maaripothundi.
When it is not sweet, it turns out to be salt.
Lek matti ga maaripothundi.
Otherwise, it would become sand.
Kanuka chakkariki dharmamu tea.
So the dharma of sugar is sweetness.
Agniki dharmamu vedi velturu.
The dharma of fire is its heat and light.
ఐస్కు ధర్మము చల్లదనము.
ది ధర్మ ఆఫ్ ఐస్ ఇస్ ఇట్స్ కోల్డ్నెస్.
అదే విధముగానే మానవునికి ధర్మం ఏమిటి?
సిమిలర్లీ వాట్ ఇస్ ద ధర్మ ఆఫ్ అ హ్యూమన్ బీయింగ్?
నీతి నిజాయితీతో కూడినటువంటి త్యాగమే ధర్మం.
ది సాక్రిఫైస్ సఫ్యూజ్డ్ విత్ మొరాలిటీ అండ్ ఇంటెగ్రిటీ ఇస్ ద ధర్మ ఆఫ్ హ్యూమన్ బీయింగ్స్.
ఈ యొక్క ధర్మం ఏ రీతిగా ఉంటుండాలి?
హౌ షుడ్ దిస్ ధర్మ బి ప్రెసెంట్?
త్రికరణ శుద్ధిగా ఉంటుండాలి.
It should be present as purity in thought, word and deed. The thoughts we think, the words that are spoken, the work done. Humanity is that which is adorned with the unity of these three.
కనుకనే ఈనాటి మానవుని యందు ఈ మూడు లేకుండా పోవటం చేతనే ధర్మము క్షీణించింది.
Since there is lack of purity in thought, word and deed in man today, there is decline in dharma.
కనుకనే విజ్ఞానం అనేటువంటిది రూపుమాసింది.
Due to which knowledge is destroyed.
దేశం యొక్క క్షేమము సౌభాగ్యమంతా కూడా నిర్మూలమైపోయింది.
The country's happiness and good fortune is completely ruined.
కేవలం భద్రతనే లేకుండా పోతుండాలి.
There is also an absence of security.
న్యాయ నిజాయితీనే శూన్యమైపోతుండాలి.
Morality and integrity have become null.
అంతా ధనము ధనము ధనము.
Everything is money, money and money.
మన ధనము చేతనే ఈ నీతి నిజాయితీలను కోల్పోతున్నాము.
Because of this money, we are losing out on morality and integrity.
నీతి నిజాయితీలు కోల్పోయి సంపాదించినటువంటి ధనము మట్టితో సమానం.
Money which is earned by compromising morality and integrity is equivalent to mud. Such money will never follow you.
కేవలం పోగు చేసి బద్ధం చేసుకున్నంత మాత్రమే నా సుఖ సంతోషం ఇస్తుందా?
Merely by holding and guarding it, will it give you joy and happiness? No, no.
తేనెటీగలు ప్రతి ఒక్క పుష్పమునందు కూడా తేనెను పోగు చేసుకుని ఒక దగ్గర వచ్చి చేరుస్తాయి.
హనీ బీస్ గో అరౌండ్ ఈచ్ అండ్ ఎవ్రీ ఫ్లవర్, కలెక్ట్ ద హనీ అండ్ గెట్ ఇట్ టు వన్ ప్లేస్.
తాను ఏమాత్రము అనుభవించక ఒక దగ్గర చేర్చి ఉంచుతాయి.
వితౌట్ ఎంజాయింగ్ ఇట్ ఈవెన్ అ బిట్, దే కలెక్ట్ ఇట్ ఇన్ అ ప్లేస్.
వేటగాడు దానికి పొగను చల్లి లేక వేడి నీరు చల్లి వాటిని చంపివేసి ఆ యొక్క తేనెను తాను అపహరిస్తున్నాడు.
But the hunter, using smoke or by pouring hot water, kills the bees and confiscates the honey.
కనుకనే అన్యాయమైనటువంటి దీనిలో ఆర్జించినటువంటి ధనము మనకు ఏమాత్రం కూడా చిక్కదు.
Hence the money which is earned through unlawful ways would never remain in our grasp.
దీనికి నలుగురు దొంగలు ఉంటున్నారు.
There are four thieves for it.
మొట్టమొదటి దొంగ గవర్నమెంట్.
The first thief is the government.
ఏదో ఒక ట్యాక్స్ కిందనో ఏదో ఒక రైడ్ కిందనో జరిపి దానిని కొంతవరకు అపహరిస్తారు.
ఇన్ ద ఫార్మ్ ఆఫ్ సమ్ ట్యాక్స్ ఆర్ రైడ్ దే వుడ్ కన్ఫిస్కేట్ అ పార్ట్ ఆఫ్ ఇట్.
రెండవది అగ్ని.
ద సెకండ్ వన్ ఇస్ ద ఫైర్.
అది ఏదో ఒక విధంగా కూడా దహింపజేసి ఈ అన్యాయ సహితమైనటువంటి ధనమును అపహరిస్తుంది.
ఇన్ సమ్ ఆర్ ది అదర్ వే ఇట్ బర్న్స్ డౌన్ ది అన్లాఫుల్ మనీ అండ్ స్వాలోస్ ఇట్.
మూడవది దొంగ.
The third one is the thief or a robber.
ధనము మన దగ్గర చేరిందంటే,
when money accumulates with us,
దొంగ దృష్టి మనపైన పడుతుంటారు.
The vision of thief falls on us.
అతను ఏదో ఒక దీనిని పురస్కరించుకుని దారిని కాచి,
he comes up with some plan or the other, waits by the wayside,
అపహరించడానికి ప్రయత్నిస్తాడు,
and tries to rob you.
ఇంకా నాలుగవది.
Then the fourth one,
రోగం.
Disease.
ఈ ధనము వల్ల దీనిని క్షీణింపజేయడానికి అనేక విధమైనటువంటి రోగములు ప్రారంభమవుతాయి.
బికాస్ ఆఫ్ సచ్ మనీ, జస్ట్ టు కన్స్యూమ్ ఇట్, ఎ వెరైటీ ఆఫ్ డిజీజెస్ స్టార్ట్ అపియరింగ్.
నోరు తెరిచి అడిగినటువంటి ఒక బిచ్చగానికైనా ఒక నయా పైసా వెయ్యరు. కానీ ఈ రోగమే వచ్చిందంటే డాక్టర్స్ కు వేలు వేలు ఏమాత్రమైన కూడా లెక్క చేయకుండా త్యాగం చేస్తారు.
దే విల్ నాట్ బి రెడీ టు పార్ట్ విత్ అ పెనీ. Even when a beggar pleads, but when disease strikes, they will sacrifice thousands and thousands without even counting.
కనుకని ఈ విధమైనటువంటి ఒక న్యాయరహితమైన దీంట్లో వచ్చినటువంటి ధనము ఈ రకమైనటువంటి మార్గంలో వ్యర్థమైపోతుంటారు.
So the money which is earned through such unlawful means would get wasted away thus.
So that was the next part of the clip. Very, very interesting. So many things which Swami was telling there, but of course, continuing with the theme of dharma, where I think this entire discourse Swami has been emphasizing on the importance of dharma, and Swami spoke of how it has been passed on through the epics, and how the Indian culture, in fact, for that matter, any civilization, any culture, which has stood the test of time, has held morality and dharma higher than anything else. And Swami was saying that Indian culture too is like that, and how in various ways it has been propagating dharma. In this point, again, Swami is coming back to the thing of how the Indian culture is represented by this this term dharma, because it really does not have an equivalent word in English. I don't know if it's there in any other language, any of the other classical languages, but the word dharma is quite a potent one. In fact, many of the words which Swami speaks of for the dharma, kshama or daya, all of this has very, very complicated meaning. And very beautifully Swami goes on to explain what is dharma, what is, in a very simple manner, we've heard it from Swami many, many times, Swami defines dharma, right?
And here one thing, the way Swami speaks about dharma, says the dharma of fire is heat and light, and the dharma of ice is cold, right? And this is an elaboration of the very cryptic statement that what is dharma, dharayate iti dharma. So the lesson that we learn is that essentially dharma is what being true to our intrinsic nature.
Right.
Right. The, in a sense, the duty that you have taken on. Like for the way we look at it, so Swami explains, you know, the sun has a certain duty and the trees have their own duty. So the rivers have their own duty, right? So the way Bhagwan is speaking about dharma, it is your intrinsic nature, the reason for which you exist, right? And so Swami then explains, so if you look at a person, what is his dharma? And Swami very clearly he states, it is sacrifice that is born out of truth and morality. Because for Bhagwan, that is what a person is, right? The way we look at each other, we do not have that perception of ourselves. But for Swami, we are well and truly that embodiments of divine.
Mm-hmm.
And so consistent with that, Swami says that that is actually your true nature, and hence your dharma is this sacrifice born out of truth and morality.
Right. And of course many examples which Swami was giving, very beautiful ones, where he spoke about fire, spoke about sugar, where Swami was saying that, I mean, again goes back to that thing which Swami was speaking last week, where when you say a name, you know, you associate a certain quality with that. When you, the idea of something intrinsic about everything that you speak of, I mean, that intrinsic quality is what is dharma. And Swami would often say, you know, when you speak of man, what are the qualities that you expect in man? As you're saying, essentially Swami would always associate the human qualities with divine qualities. As we have mentioned once before, when somebody made this statement in Swami's presence, I think in a speech or something, to err is human. And Swami got very upset with that, and in his discourse he said, I don't know where people pick up quotes like this. And who said to err is human? To be divine is human. To be by nature divine. That is the human quality.
Oh.
No, don't associate yourself with errors, and don't give yourself, you know, space to, you know, do such mistakes and say that it's human to do such mistakes. And I mean, you will be there if you say it's all right to make mistakes.
Right. It really astonishing, you know, the very high standard that
exactly,
Swami expects from all of us, like devotees. And Swami again further elaborates, even if we didn't get the message the first time. So Swami says that what is the dharma of humanity? Swami says it is, as we said, sacrifice born out of truth. But very importantly, he points out that all this is great. Then how do you demonstrate this? And Swami goes back to that very fundamental message of Trikarana Shuddhi.
Right.
I think this message, you know, it stands out because if you look at Bhagwan's life, you know, look for the teachings, you'll see that this was among the first. Mm. The first play that Swami wrote, you know, Cheppinattu Chestara, this was the first teaching, you could very boldly say, that Swami gave out to the world. And the very fundamental thing, that unity of thought, word and deed. This stands out in particular. So, because Swami would emphasize, you know, that there should be unity in the thought, word and deed. And he said that this is how your true qualities will come out.
Mm.
Right? If you look at, again, going back to the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, you can see that the people who stood out there were those who stood for their word. Like, if you look at Lord Rama himself, right, in this, in the Hindi there's a saying like, pran jaye par vachan na jaye. And they say that the embodiment of that stickler to one's word was Lord Rama. So Swami says that this is the basis, right, this is the foundation on which all other human qualities they grow. And which is very important for us to understand that, and it is very easily overlooked by each one of us. This unity of thought, word and deed, and actually in some sense it is in very small things you can practice it, no? Like even things like being on time, right, the small promises that we make, we can actually begin there, because many times we are blindsided by those things, right? I mean, not to disparage any form of spiritual undertakings that we do, but sometimes in those big things we tend to forget the very small things. But Swami is reminding us, you know, that that at the basis, at the foundation of all such spiritual endeavors, there must be this basis of unity of thought, word and deed. And it might, you know, nullify or invalidate every other practice that you do.
No, once apparently Swami was telling a group of devotees in the interview room, where we know there's I think quote which is there in the Ramayana, it's there in some form, Krishna also declaring it, when he says that the moment a devotee comes and says, Lord, I am yours, I surrender to you, I protect him, I give him my protection unconditionally. So Swami was explaining the statement where Swami said, see, when I tell I will protect you, I mean it to the last letter. Right? That's how I speak. When I say something, I mean it. So when I am like that, when a devotee comes and tells me that, Lord, I am yours, I surrender to you, I take your word for it. And Swami is saying, that is why even if you tell simply that, Lord, I am yours, the Lord will actually come, you know, come to your protection. Right. Swami was saying that, see, that is my nature and I want you to be in that nature. When you say something, you should really mean it. And I mean, if you look at it, everything else, you know, anything we do in life, be it, you know, we start walking on the road.
Yeah.
I mean, why is it that, let's say there are potholes on the road, or when you're driving, the road is uneven, it's broken. Why is it, why is that creating a problem? Because the inability for us to predict how the road is going to be.
Right.
We want a certain amount of dependability, even in small things.
Absolutely.
You want, as Swami was saying, when somebody sells you sugar, you want that sugar to be sweet.
Yeah.
That is the association you have with that object that you are buying. So everything we indulge in life, everything we use, we want a certain amount of dependability and predictability in that. So that is the same thing when you talk about human interactions.
Exactly.
I should be able to take your word for it. And you know, we see that in every sphere of life. For, I mean, in business, the goodwill that you earn, which actually sometimes they value it much, much more than even movable and immovable properties, the goodwill that the company has earned. And sometimes you would see companies going out of the way to ensure, as you're saying, the customer satisfaction, which some of the companies which actually hold very high, is because of this. That dependability, that goodwill which is earned, that is what defines them. You know that, okay, this company, if it says something, it stands for it. And that's how even a person stands out. You know, I can depend on this person. Same thing if you take sports. You know, they would have, even in cricket you have these things. You don't know certain times whether the catch has been taken or it's not taken. So they will know that, okay, you can go by the, you know, the fielders, whatever he says. If he says he takes the, he has taken the catch, you can go by it, because you associate sportsmanship with that honesty, with that kind of straight play.
Imagine, when you think about this, would you walk into an aeroplane, step into an aeroplane, if you did not know that the hundreds of engineers, you know, every day, the maintenance engineers, if they were not doing their job with integrity, right?
Right.
And because in that, even a very, very small mistake could prove, a small oversight, you know, by an engineer, it could prove fatal, right? So actually, as you very well pointed out, and we even discussed this earlier, that entire society, like, it runs reliably and smoothly when we are our word, right? Or, for example, this chair. I can reliably, dependably sit on this chair because it has been maintained in such a way. If the chair did not do its job, it would, in fact, no longer be a chair.
Right.
And that's why Swami says that if you are a human, the quality that defines a human is actually this unity of thought, thought, word and deed.
Right.
And if you do not follow this, you aren't that human. Mm. Just like this chair, if it collapses,
right.
it is no longer a chair.
Right? Right.
Your word collapses and you're no longer human. Mm.
And actually, if you look at the world today, the society, I think that is what is really very quickly disintegrating.
Yeah.
Where somebody says something, we need another person, another agency, another form of validating what
yeah.
someone is saying. I mean, constantly we're having to do this. Mm. You know, somebody says that we are the number one company in this field. Then you need to have some data to find out whether he's, you know, the company is speaking the truth or not. You have another agency which gives that rating, and then you have some other agency which validates the agency which is giving the rating.
Correct.
Because we are not able to trust any of these things. And coming to that idea of dharma, Swami would often say this, that dharma never disintegrates. Dharma never comes down. It is only the practice of dharma which comes down. Which again, Swami is saying here, you know, the practice of dharma is falling in the society today. And it is leading to, as beautifully Swami said, it is leading to a fall in security. A sense of security is what is becoming the casualty.
And Swami is straight away pointing out at the first thing that becomes a casualty, which is education.
Right.
Education losing its value. Because you should understand that when we say teacher, right, or if I am a teacher, I do not become a teacher because I am paid a certain amount of salary or that is my designation. Right? Again, a teacher has a certain promise that is associated with mm-hmm. it. When I am a teacher, I am a promise to society that I will teach the students and guide them.
Right.
Right? There's a expectation from society. See, here again, there's a little bit of a, you know, something to be discussed. So what is the job of a teacher, right? So it might say right there in your contract that what you're expected to do, as put on paper, is for you to teach and get marks
right.
from the students. But there's an unspoken requirement from a teacher, right, that society expects and relies upon a teacher, is to put the student on the right path.
Right.
Right. And sometimes the parents themselves may have thrown up their hands, but they look towards a teacher to do that.
Mm.
And that is why Swami says that the moment that dharma is absent, the first casualty is education itself. And Swami points out to the other pillar of society, which is healthcare.
Mm.
Right. In for Swami, these two are matters that are so close to his heart, that they're so important to society, that Swami would say that this has to be free for the only reason that it should not be tainted by money.
Mm.
Right? So, one thing we should understand that Swami is the Lord himself. Right? And he has at his beck and the moment he wills it, there can be a ton of money that can shower anywhere. Right? But yet Swami would insist, you know, that as people who work in his institutions, in his hospitals, the aspect of service should be very high, right? More than that hankering after money, the hankering after wealth, right? And comforts. The service aspect has to be that important.
Right.
And society does the exact opposite.
Mm.
Education in India itself, when you look at it, it's turned into such a huge business. But if you go to the United States, it's a very sad story.
Mm-hmm.
Because there, even today I was reading this story about how nowadays students, the moment they step out of their graduation, what is weighing most on their minds is that huge debt that they are now carrying.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are, the culprits are directly the for-profit colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And more, you know, the society is looking to exploit students. If I begin speaking about the different ways, it can be endless. But just to compare, you know, the times between what we experience as students and now, right? Nowadays, you might even have to pay for doing your homework because some company is owning your homework.
Oh.
Yes. The textbooks, even the homework or assignments are now administered over a website. And for you to access that website, you need to pay a license fee, right? So even for such things, so that there is idea that you have to monetize, you know, every little aspect that is possible,
right?
And somebody was telling me, you know, they had lost somebody dear to them, and they were looking at the medical bill after they have paid. You know, normally at that point of time, it doesn't occur to you to look at, you know, what you were charged for. Much later, when they were looking at the bill, one of the things they realized that they had been charged was for using the waiting room.
Mm.
Right? Because when you're charged for everything else in the entire hospital, they looked at that one area where you're not, there is floor space and you're not earning money out of that. And they realize that's where the dear ones, you know, they're sitting with all that worry, and they would happily pay up that whatever price is charged at that place. So that is a telling commentary on where society has gone today, where it has lost its compassion. And it's something we really need to look at, Prem. And I don't think that, so when Swami has set up these hospitals, you know, today an elder was speaking to us about the vision that Swami had. So this vision was not to have the central trust, you know, establish more and more hospitals mushrooming all over the country. Swami said that wasn't his intention. Swami's intention was that by looking at this one example, Swami wanted to prove that it is possible. People can do it, but they do not. And Swami wanted to inspire the many philanthropists, the rich industrialists of this country, who have earned more, like, you know, than they would ever need. Yeah. Not only what they need, but generations down.
True.
More than what they need, and it is possible for them to do this. This is what Swami very, very clearly he told. Vallu cheyachu kani cheyatledu. That's what Swami used to tell in Telugu. They can do it, but they do not. And Swami wanted to show that it is possible for you to do this.
Right.
And that's what that elder was, you know, he said that these people have now therefore gone out and set up hospitals, but they still charge so much money from patients. Just to give an example, you know, I was looking at recently there was a scheme that was floated by the government, you know, regarding for providing low cost medicines to the poor of this country, right?
Okay.
And I was very curious because definitely that is something, if we can at our hospital, if we can bring the cost of the medicines down, then that is some avenue you definitely look at. Right? And so I was very curious. I asked, I got in touch with them. In fact, they got in touch with us and they shared their rate list, and astounded that we had the prices at which we were procuring good quality medicines from very good manufacturing plants was still far less than what the government was offering in their rate list, which tells you the extent to which these
rates are inflated in other,
yeah, the stranglehold that industry has. Right? So we should understand that definitely there is an element of compassion that society needs, which goes beyond greed, which is wired. The problem is that it is wired into our minds to think that our survival depends on exploitation of others. And that's why Swami says, no, that essentially the money, what we must understand is the money thus gained, Swami is telling very clearly in this discourse that it doesn't stay with you. Right? And not, of course, Swami does say that money comes and goes and it is morality which comes and grows. But Swami is saying that the money that comes in an unfair way will go much faster than the, you know, the money that you earn in the legitimate fashion. And Swami very clearly says that, you know, there is no telling that how the money will go out of your hands. There is definitely taxes. Then we can never say, you know, how other natural acts, they can take away all this wealth in a flash. And so Swami says it is something we must understand, that something we are placing our emphasis or building the foundation of our life on something so flimsy, which can disappear, you know, in a trice, right?
Actually, it's a very important point. You know, you can, many of us can observe this in people around us, you know, people who have gathered money through probably not the best of ways. You will see that sometimes, you know, there'll be a medical emergency and you would find that somebody else, it would be a small thing, but these people would end up in some complication which cannot be spoken of, and they land up in some hospital like this by which they, you know, they spend more than they would have otherwise spent. And the idea is they would probably think that thank God I made the money because I'm able to spend it now when I have a need. But you don't realize that it's that excess money which is being taken away in this form, as Swami is saying, that, you know, these are these four thieves which take away that money that you've earned more than what is your worth, more than what is the effort that you've put in.
Exactly.
And thankfully, you know, even as you're talking about education and how it is becoming so commercial, I think you can see it every day. But thankfully, you have this other, you know, side of the story where you have these big universities trying to make their, you know, material open source. You are able to access their classrooms. You're able to access lectures for free. You have these very, very good academicians trying to make course material of some of the best courses available for free. I think that is the thing. I mean, there's always, dharma is never taken away. I think the beauty is that, you know, even when Swami has set up the university or the hospital, when Swami says that this is a proof that this can be done, I think that's a validation of what Swami calls dharma. Saying that, see, it's practice of dharma never goes out of fashion or out of context.
Correct.
Even today, even in the worst of situation around, if you choose to hold on to dharma, you will see the results of that.
Absolutely.
And that is why Swami says dharma never declines.
The use because of dharma essentially declines. That is again a validation of the fact that that is our true nature.
Right.
And nobody can take it away from us. Right. Like no matter how much mankind is drawn towards like greed and survival, and people might say that this is a, you know, the it grows worse generation after generation, but that's a false perception. Because in spite of all that, you'll always see dharma still rebounding and making a comeback.
Right.
And so Swami, you know, on the one hand, of course, in the discourse we are seeing, Swami is saying that essentially dharma, you got to practice because the when you turn away from dharma, the consequences, right? There are Swami is listing all of these that could happen and take away that happiness that you have falsely gained. But I have seen, you know, how Swami becomes so happy when people do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Swami would praise endlessly that happiness is something. So many people like you, so many times, and Swami would come out of the interview room and speak with so much happiness of a thing that a person has done. You would recall, of course, that very famous discourse where Swami spoke about that boy, you know, who decided to contribute to the water project by giving up his, you know, that expenditure of paying to the dhobi. You know, it was very small charges of, say, 50 rupees or may have been 25 rupees per month at that time. He saved that money by washing the clothes himself, you know, and then gave that money to Swami, right, as a small contribution to the water project. And that is spoken of even now. Because it granted Swami, it gave Swami so much happiness to speak about it and then hear about it from all of us.
Right.
I can, you know, one small, very small incident that took place in my life. This was once, you know, after a Grama Seva, after the birthday celebrations, Swami was distributing clothes, you know, but Swami had announced that the clothes are meant for the staff and students of the university. And at that time I was sitting in the Vedam group, and the Vedam group always used to be essentially composed of staff and students. And there were only a handful of us, you know, who were not students or the staff of the institute at that time. We were not lecturers. We were working in the ashram and various trust offices, but we were part of that group. And so it was very clear to me that I was not meant to be one of the recipients, right? And the people who were distributing it, they would come over, and so one person, he showed it to me. I was able to tell that particular teacher, I'm not meant to take it, sir. You give it to someone else. And soon after, you know, a very senior person, he came and handed it over to me. And I couldn't say no, you know, he just plonked it on my lap. So then after he went away quickly, you know, handed it back to another teacher and so on. Because I was very clear, when Swami has said for whom it is meant, you cannot violate that. Right? And I was sitting there, and of course this is the birthday time, right? And it's a blessing to receive clothes from Swami. And no matter how much in my heart, on the one side I was glad that I'd done the right thing. But on the other hand, I'm looking at all the people around me, they're happily opening their packets and looking at the clothes that Swami had given. And a part of me was so sad, you know, that I hadn't got this very precious gift from Bhagwan. But 2 or 3 minutes later, you know, and I must mention at this point of time that Swami was at least 15 or 20 yards away from where all this was transpiring. And I remember the whole time his back was to us. He was speaking to Professor Anil Kumar the whole time when this distribution was going on. So his back was to us. Then Swami, you know, walked to the a little ahead towards where we were seated, the Vedam group was seated. And from there, Swami announced Central Trust Boys. Right? Mm-hmm. And my heart leapt because I was so happy that we were going to get the clothes. And from Swami's hands itself. Mm. The important thing is, like, when Swami called me, right, to hand over the clothes, he said that first a teacher came and he gave you the clothes and you said no. Mm. And then he mentioned my name. In fact, I can mention it. It was Dr. Venkatraman.
Okay.
Dr. Venkatraman came and you took the clothes from him, right? Mm. And he made a mock angry face. I said, no, Swami, I returned it. And Swami said, very good boy. Mm. And then he gave the clothes. Right? Mm. It was such a beautiful experience, right? Mm. And at birthday time, it was a very, what shall I say, important message. Mm. Because when I look at, I can always remember that the way Swami's face changed, no, that mock anger to such happiness. That you did the right thing. Mm. Right? And it is always a reminder that this is what grants God happiness, that you doing the right thing is what makes him happy.
Right.
And therefore you must do it. It's not out of fear of all the consequences, but the fact that you can light up God's heart.
Right.
Right. That is what he is looking for in all of us.
It's beautiful. I think this clip was very, very, as we are seeing that, you know, as discourse goes towards the end, how it becomes more and more practical from the more abstract. I mean, the definition of dharma is actually so beautiful. And it's for everybody. It's not, you know, when Swami says, I mean, we see that in our home. When you see adulteration in some of the things which we buy from the shop, how does it put us off? You know, when you buy something, when you buy a rice, when you buy a dal,
absolutely.
When you find something which is not meant to be there, how it irritates us. I think that we'll have to keep that in mind, that when somebody is interacting with us, if we are something else than what we portray, if we are something else than what is expected of us, and I think we are as bad as the Swami is saying that you buy sugar and it's not sweet, it cannot be sugar at all.
Absolutely.
I think every moment in that, I think probably, you know, when we are sitting here and saying that we are, you know, reading out Swami's message and we are discussing it, as honest as we can, we'll have to do that. You know, have I done my effort? Have I done my part of the thing? Have we done our part of the programming, and then are we presenting it? Same is the case with the doctor. I think that sense of responsibility, as somebody was saying, apparently in the past, the doctors had an unsaid practice.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they have a patient admitted and they come and see that patient over a period of a few days or a few weeks, let's say that one of the visits they come and that is the time when the patient actually passes away. They're not able to, save the patient. For that visit, the doctor does not charge, even though he charges for all the other visits. That was something like an written ethic they followed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was like the doctor, one thing is sympathizing with the event which has happened.
Absolutely. Yes.
And to an extent taking responsibility for what has happened. He's saying, see, I am treating the patient, I could not save the patient. So it is not right on my part to charge for this visit when I have not been able to save the patient. But now you see the completely opposite part, where the doctor charges much, much more for the consultation that he's providing, suggesting that, you know, this is the value of the service I'm offering, but trying to pull away from all the responsibility of the repercussions of his treatment by saying that, you know, I've done my best. If something has happened, I'm not responsible for that.
Yeah, and that, according to Swami, that is so demeaning the practice of medicine. And so that's also like demeaning the same thing that happens in education. Like Swami used to be very, very pained about this. Like a few days ago, somebody was sharing about in a very small forum of us students who had gathered, the alumni who work in the institute, we had all gathered, and there's one brother who was updating us about the efforts that are going out for the archival of Swami's literature. The several photos, the several videos, but the most precious treasure being Swami's notebooks, in which he has made several notings, and I had the opportunity, I mentioned this earlier, of casually going through some of what Swami had written, right? And it is astounding the amount that Swami has written on education. You could very clearly see that this was something that was very close to Swami's heart. And the way that present society, we are treating this such an important treasure called education, such things that are so important as healthcare, right? It is really saddening and a wake-up call for humanity itself.
Right. And I think we'll end with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very, very beautiful clip, as we were saying, Swami speaking on dharma and how money corrupts this idea of dharma, and the end, the warning that Swami gave, money accumulated in the wrong way, you know, there are 4 leakages which can happen. Swami said one is through the taxes. I mean, that's nothing new for us, especially right now. There's so much of talk going on about the different kinds of taxes.
Yeah.
But Swami is saying how, you know, in different ways it can be taken away from you. And one is being what is the legal way, actually. Legally, what you have earned can be taken away. And that is one way, Swami is saying. The other way is the stealthy way, where a thief comes and takes it away. Or you could have it through an accident where you lose. There's another discourse also where Swami mentions this,
mm-hmm.
where fire is actually an agent of God to take away the money which is not, mm-hmm. you know, yours, which has not been earned through your righteous effort.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally Swami is saying about how health becomes an issue. And I think we've seen this, you know, people who have led very, very good lives.
Right.
They very seamlessly pass over from one birth, you know, to the afterlife. Where you see that they're healthy till the last minute and they don't have any issues with their, they need any medical attention.
Absolutely.
And we see this, especially with Swami's devotees, we've seen so many of them so effortlessly, passing through that stage of old age. So I think we'll end with that. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining us. Join us again for the continuation of this final discourse in the 1991 Summer Course series, which was delivered on the 2nd of June, 1991. We most humbly offer our effort at Swami's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his guests for the last segment of today, the Vahini Satsang. And we'll join you again at 7:30 p.m. next week for the next episode of Shravanam, Mananam, and Nididhyasanam.